You're listening to PX Pulse, a regular podcast bringing you fresh voices on critical issues facing HIV prevention research today. Earlier this year, the U.S. government's National Institutes of Health Division of AIDS, or DAIDS for short, published its Funding Opportunity Announcement, or FOA. The FOA signals its research priorities for the next seven-year funding cycle for HIV research from 2021 to 2027. Among these priorities, DAIDS is asking for funding applications that will investigate antibodies, vaccines, interventions based on using antiretrovirals as prevention, also research on social and behavioral strategies, and multipurpose prevention technologies called MPTs. At a live-streamed meeting about the funding opportunities, DAIDS leader Carl Dieffenbach singled out the need to make adherence easier, and he and his colleague Cheryl Zwirsky addressed whether topically applied microbicides would be supported in the next funding cycle. Keep in mind, topical products are considered non-systemic, unlike a potential vaccine or a pill, which provides systemic protection throughout the body.
We have this issue, not just in prevention, but also in therapy as well, of adherence. We are seeking methods that really help us deal with the adherence issues. Melissa, dive right in.
Microbicides. Well, I mean, what is the official position?
So microbicides are could be covered within the prevention network. That is up to the applicant to decide what they are choosing to write to. As part of the FOA, Cheryl, you want to add a few words?
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent question. As I think you can probably see if you've looked at the FOAs, the major thrust is systemic protection or protection from all routes of acquisition. That said, we also built into the FOA the ability to take really any product or strategy that appears to be compelling and meet a public health need and be comparable to, you know, I think one of the things that we talked about a little bit is about, of course, the efficacy and safety of current PrEP and wanting to approximate those and having a sense that that might be the case. We could take forward any product that is compelling as far as efficacy, safety, and public health need.
At AVAC, we were glad to hear this opening for non-systemic options. Because it can't be said enough, no option under investigation can do the job alone. No one method will ever be enough. But with a diverse portfolio of interventions used in combination, there just might be the right tools at hand one day to defeat the epidemic. On PX Pulse this episode, we're going to talk about what's in the research pipeline now, what the research agenda should look like over the next 7 years, and what a science of choice agenda might look like. To explore all this, researcher, former president of the International AIDS Society, and one of the leaders at the Desmond Tutu HIV Foundation, Linda Gale Becker, has joined us. Linda Gale, help us understand some of the strengths and limitations of the prevention pipeline today, from oral PrEP and condoms to vaccine trials and the dapivirine ring and more.
My starting point is it's terrific to have prevention options, number one. Number two, we know how important, you know, that notion of options are, how choice really is critical for people to be able to wrap something that isn't absolutely needed, if you like, the same way treatment is, for instance, that people can wrap their lives around the product or the product can be wrapped around their lives. That's absolutely key. So oral PrEP I love because it's here and it's usable. That clearly is the word on everyone's lips. It's the thing we're really grappling with at the moment. Of course, condoms are there and always will be and are very much the mainstay of our prevention toolbox, but oral PrEP is the new kid on the block and very exciting. It clearly has some drawbacks. People, you know, really need to have in their minds to have taken the oral PrEP consistently daily to make sure that there is sufficient drug at the site where they may encounter the virus. we know that that can be challenging for some. It isn't always easy, particularly those individuals who are on the younger side, whose lives may be very full of all sorts of other priorities. That is sometimes a tall order. So we have to keep working at improving how we message PrEP, how we get oral PrEP out there, but it clearly has some limitations for some. For some, of course, it's terrific. The vaginal ring, close to my heart, because clearly designed for women, very important for women, potentially again, but early days for us. We need to see where that is going to land in both regulatory, but also which kind of woman is going to particularly want to take the vaginal ring into their lives and make it work for them. And of course, this isn't just about types of people. It may be times in people's lives. As we often say, the analogy here is contraception. We know as women, we may start with a particular method, but then move into other methods over a period of time. And I think that is very much the reality here. So those are the, you know, two, along with, of course, condoms and female condoms that are currently available to us. But very exciting that there are others in the pipeline.
Some other things in the pipeline right now are long-acting injectable cabotegravir, several vaccine candidates in efficacy trials. There's also a lot of research going on with broadly neutralizing antibodies. There's exploration into multipurpose technologies. They tackle HIV while simultaneously protecting against either other sexually transmitted diseases or providing contraception. We can dream big about the protection levels we might see from any of these interventions that are not yet proven. But these two all have one kind of limitation or another. Tell us about these.
Well, we'd love to think that the vaccines, perhaps the BNABs, are going to give us high levels of protection. And, you know, maybe even long-acting cabotegravir could be there, given that oral PrEP, if taken consistently, you know, is upwards in the high 90s. The likelihood is all of these are going to be partial, at least for the foreseeable future. The first generation of prophylactic vaccines are probably going to be partially effective, if truth be told. The BNABs may well be very effective to begin with, but again, there is the worry in the back of our heads about viral mutant escape. We know that this virus is incredibly wily. It has incredible mutability, and you know the chances that even some of our best BNABs might be something a virus could work around over a period of time has to be something, you know, we're all thinking about as we develop them. So it may be that, you know, again, we're looking at combinations of either BNABs or combinations of BNABs with vaccines or combinations of BNABs with PrEP, you know, going down the line. As you've already alluded to, for the foreseeable future, people are going to have to maybe mix and match or to be very aware of what the limitations of their prevention modality is so that they go into their sexual and intimate lives knowing what the odds are of protection.
So all these methods of protection have different ways they could pose a challenge to one individual or another while also potentially offering promising benefits. With that in mind, what do you want in the research agenda for the next 7 years?
I would like to suggest that we want, for the reasons you've just raised, I think we want to optimize all of these, and it sounds, you know, greedy, but I do think they each have, as much as they each have disadvantages, they each have advantages. There are going to be people, and I know this, who even with the best injectable are still going to be really worried about needles and prefer to take something that they can pop as a pill. You know, then they're going to be people who don't like the idea of any kind of chemical coming into their bodies, and then a vaginal ring or a microbicide is going to be a better option for them. There are going to be those who feel that actually they can't be bothered with prevention on its own, and the notion of, you know, knocking prevention and contraception on the head together is the way to go, and that, you know, it makes perfect sense for their lives that an MPT works. So I really want to make a very strong case for the fact that we should not be limiting the field unless we really do get a strong signal that that particular modality has no hope of really having any kind of niche uptake. Now, having said that, I think we have to be very careful that our clinical trials don't always give us a good sense of what people are really going to use and want to use down the pike. I think we've seen evidence that when we, with prevention, which is a little unlike other fields of medicine, that the clinical trials in a way don't give us a good idea of how things are going to look when we move to scale up. All of the open labels to date have done better than the placebo-controlled trials. Now, I suppose the good thing is, in a way, those placebo-controlled trials are becoming less and less likely to happen simply because PrEP, as we know it today, is because it's so effective, it's going to have to be in the mix somewhere, in some shape or form. So I think from here on out, our science is going to invoke choice and decision making. So I do think it is, you know, beholden of all of us to move into the science of choice, understanding how our decisions, what motivates those decisions, what are some of the factors in young women versus men who have sex with men, younger people versus older people, people who access healthcare easily versus people who don't easily get into the healthcare system. What are the factors that help them make decisions about their prevention on the one hand? And then secondly, how do we then, depending on their preferences, how do we make our various modalities more accessible? And I do think we have to think outside of the box. So I think it's a wonderful era we're moving into where we will see the innovation, the R&D moving along, and I'm so excited. And I do think there does need to be more emphasis on less frequent dosing. I'm hoping what I deem or what I've called the science of choice becomes something we spend a whole lot more time, understanding. And, of course, that is human behavior. So it does bring us the full circle back to behavioral studies in our biomedical era.
I'm very intrigued by your science of choice. You want behavioral science right up there in a lead position in your research agenda.
Certainly, Jane. I mean, I would argue that what the last 10 years have taught us is we have not had sufficient of that in our agenda. And I think, to our peril, I think it slows down how we get these products out into the field more effectively.
And in addition to behavioral science in research and development, what else do you think should be a priority?
I think this notion of the less frequent dosing is a big one. I think it's more important than the systemic, in my opinion. Not to clash with Dave, I absolutely understand where they're coming from, that, maybe the notion that people can have multiple sites of infection, therefore having systemic cover, it sounds like an efficient way to go, and I totally get that, and I endorse that. But I actually think, I do think that frequency of dosing is something that is a tough one for some people to get over and challenging, as I think oral PrEP has shown. And so unless we address that, that's going to continue to be a stumbling block for some folk who just and I'm in that, I have to say, I'm in that bucket. I had tuberculosis a couple of times, and I had to do daily observed therapy because I'm just a terrible, terrible pill taker. So it's got nothing to do with one's understanding of the subject, or it's about just being able to organize oneself and make sure that you can do a daily intervention, and I seem to be terrible at it. So there's a confession from my part that, this is just hard to do, and that's my personality type. So if I had to choose a PrEP methodology for me, I would definitely go for a less frequent dosing. 6 monthly or even annually would be just terrific. And that's why I'm a great believer in vaccines as well. I mean, ultimately, I hope the vaccine will be something we'll be able to prime and boost and then boost intermittently.
You mentioned DAIDS, the Division of AIDS at NIH and its priorities and preference for systemic protection. DAIDS did carve out a path to potentially fund topical, non-systemic prevention strategies. Those strategies would be considered on a case-by-case basis and have to demonstrate an agreed-upon, compelling, specific public health need, as we heard defined by Cheryl Zworski at the top of this podcast. Is there a danger, in your view, of non-systemic products falling off the research agenda?
Yes, I would imagine that could happen if the efficacy is for whatever reason, not good enough. Now, I say that a little bit guardedly because, as we have demonstrated to date, you know, oral PrEP came in at 42% in the original trial, although, of course, partners PrEP showed a much better point efficacy. The vaginal ring at the moment is teetering around 30%. I'm obviously very anxious that if we apply the notion of that's not the point efficacy is too low, and therefore we're gonna chuck it out. How would that look when we do move into real world situations? And already, as has been reported at various conferences, it looks like the open label with the vaginal ring is moving in the right direction. It's looking better than the randomized controlled trials.
And for listeners who may need this pointer, open label are studies that are done after a blinded study when all the participants know exactly what they're taking. And in certain cases, the evidence has been that adherence goes up and then often protection is higher too, right?
Correct, spot on. And then just again, also for listeners to, because I know these terms are used interchangeably and they're confusing. Efficacy really speaks to, does the product work? When taken absolutely perfectly as prescribed, as ordered, does it work? Effectiveness takes into consideration that I might not take this so well. I'm now, you know, my adherence is down, or my ability to take this injection, or the injection doesn't quite get to the place. So, in other words, all the logistical reasons why something may not work as well. So, I guess the decision being made around what isn't efficacious and who makes that decision is an important one. And I would argue that, as we have seen throughout the life of the HIV epidemic, maybe involving community to a certain extent in that decision making could also be wise.
The wisdom of involving communities directly in decisions about what's in the pipeline for research and development was at the center of a conversation between AVAC's Manju Chitanigata and two young women advocates from Zimbabwe, Audrey Nosenga and Maximina Jokanya. As Linda Gail Becker advocates for solutions that will reach into people's lives, Manju, Audrey, and Maxi began by talking about how limited that reach is right now.
Let's talk a little bit about what HIV prevention looks like in your communities now. How difficult or easy is it for young people to access current HIV prevention? And what are the products they use or the ways they prevent HIV?
In terms of HIV prevention, first of all, the thing that I want to mention is we've kind of left it behind in terms of young people accessing HIV prevention services. Let's say, for example, all the products that are coming in, are they tailor-made for young people per se? Are we educating them enough? Are we preparing them enough to take these prevention methods? Let's say, for example, in condom use, do they have access to it? Are they able to afford it in a way? Because what I feel is it their choice? Are they happy with these products? Let's say, for example, condom. Many young people say the condoms that are available, they are not our choices. We don't like them. In terms of accessibility, is it a place whereby young people can access this without being judged, without being condoned by the community? Because there is that gap between the community and the young people. Second thing, there is PrEP that is there. But my main concern in Zimbabwe is PrEP is only available for the key populations. What about the rest of the young people that you're talking about? PrEP is there, but is it reaching to the right people, to the younger generations that you're talking about in terms of prevention? Also, the ring is coming in. I know it's at the stage of, you know, development and approval, but are we communicating enough messages in terms of when it comes, will they accept it? Are we providing enough products for them to choose to use in terms of prevention? That's what that I can say, that the product that are they tailor-made for the young people or not? And also, do we make sure that young people have enough information in terms of sexual reproductive health? That's something that you also need to think about.
So, Audrey, what about your experience with the young people you work with or who are your friends? Do you know people who use PrEP? Can you talk about their experience in using PrEP?
In my community, the particular community I come from, prevention is the condom, abstinence, and PrEP. That's like the most common. It's like a chain. If you cannot abstain, then you use the condom. If the condom doesn't work, then you counter. Use PrEP. I only know of a few of my friends who are on PrEP. Seemed like all four methods didn't really work considering the fast lives of young people, their diversity, and their circumstances. People don't really understand much about prevention, what it is. We start mostly on treatment and we end there. Yeah, these are the things that I can say about prevention. No support structures, no knowledge about prevention, no knowledge about like where you go, what to do next and everything.
How do you think we can better deliver what we already have while also developing new options? And how do we make sure that these new options, when we have them, won't fall into the same problems?
I think improving is the first step, because if the same problem is still there that's making people not access a service that's already existing, if we still don't know what it is, and if we still don't know how to access to address it, then whatever option that comes will also fall in the line of whatever is causing it. So improving should be the first step, and then choices will be the next step. I need choice, ultimately, because I don't want to take something because it's being forced on me. It really doesn't speak to me. I should be able to like use the ring every day because I love it. And the next patient should be able to take ARVs or prevention options every day because they love them.
And for you, Maxie, what does choice look like in a real way in your community?
For me, in terms of relating to my community and myself as a young woman, choice is more about empowering me. Choice is coming in to give me power as a young woman in terms of how can I make sure that I take care of my own health. If my health is well taken care of, I'll be able to be someone who's active within the society. I've got that power to go on about what I want to do in life. So in terms of choice, it's more about, you know, giving me wings to fly.
All these voices, from leaders in research like Linda Gale Becker and young women community leaders like Audrey Nosanga and Maximina Jaconia, are sharing words of wisdom we hope will guide the field going forward. We're ready to champion Linda Gale Becker's science of choice as the guiding principle for the years of research ahead. We look forward to collaborating with researchers, funders, advocates, and especially the eventual users of different options to ensure that people most at risk of HIV will come to their clinic or their pharmacy or their community organization and find an array of safe, effective, and accessible choices they need to protect themselves. You've been listening to PX Pulse, recorded in the New York City studios of the Radio Foundation and the Relic Room. Our theme music was composed by Alexi Stevens. Our engineer is Sam Baer.